Your voice.
Your city.
Your issues.
Your evenings on 702.
Let's walk the talk with Aubrey Masango.
Thank you very much to Dr. Chantelle Whitten, a researcher at the University of the Western Cape, but stationed at the moment at Wits University, talking about the dangers of feeding our children, especially our infants, food that is too heavy laden with sugar, has some serious problems for us in the future. In this hour, I'm going to be speaking in the first half hour of this hour to the Minister of Home Affairs, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, who says that the Cabinet has approved a white paper overhauling the country's immigration laws after robust engagements that resulted in wide support of the document's policy position. The white paper was published in the Government Gazette for public comment in November 2023. It proposes a complete overhaul of the Citizenship Act, the Refugees Act, and the Immigration Act. And joining me now on the line is Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, Home Affairs Minister. Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you very much, Aubrey. Thank you very much for having me. Good evening to you and the listeners.
Much, much appreciated. So what does it mean that there is going to be an overhauling of these three acts, the Citizenship Act, the Refugees Act, or the Immigration Act? And maybe the question is asked wrongly. What needs to happen before that actually happens in earnest?
No, the white paper has now been passed by the Cabinet, which means it's now official policy of the country. On the basis of that policy, we have to develop a bill which will send to Parliament which will come to the public to get public comments all over the country, you know, what you call public participation.
Yes.
And then Parliament will debate that bill. If they pass it, then it becomes a law of the country and they send to the President for his signature. Now, what will the bill be all about? We are saying the Citizenship Act, which we passed in 1995, the Refugee Act, which we passed in 1998, and the Immigration Act, passed in 2002, must be repealed in their entirety. And we start from the scratch, and we no longer make them three different acts. We make them into one omnibus act with different chapters, which deals with citizenship of the country, refugee protection, and immigration.
What is the effect of this going to be? In other words, I'm trying to get a sense of what do we have and what are we changing it to?
As I'm saying, we start with a new act altogether that will deal with immigration, refugee, and refugee protection and citizenship of the country. It becomes one act. The problem, Aubrey, is that this act were passed at three different times at a different epoch, if I may say, yeah, in our country, at a different time. For instance, the Citizenship Act, if you look at it, it was passed in 1995, just 1 year after democracy, and Parliament was in a hurry to make South Africans to become citizens. Remember that in terms of the apartheid laws, people from the former TBV states, the former Transkei, Mbutswana, yes, they have to be made citizens very quickly. And so when we look at it, there are quite a number of mistakes. In fact, with it, we discovered that it is a replica of the 1949 Act that was developed when South Africa was still a union. And some ways were changed here and there, but when you look at the DNA of that act, it's still a replica of the 1949 Act. I don't know whether you have got time or interest to understand why we've got the problem about the 1949 Act.
Please do.
Because I can explain that.
Please do, Dr. Motsoaledi, because I think these are critical things that we as South Africans need to understand, yeah?
Yeah, you see, in 1949, South Africa was still a union. It was not yet a republic. And those who will know history will know that Britain, as our colonial power, was sending a lot of people to the southern African countries, including Bechuanaland Protectorate, which was a British protectorate, today is Botswana. Basutoland Protectorate, which was a British protectorate, today it is Lesotho. and then South Africa itself. Now, the people who were sent here were becoming commissioners or landdrawers or, you know, they had lots of titles or governors of whatever area and all that. Now, the British were scared that these people, because they are all men, there was not a single woman I could get in literature or in history who was ever sent from Britain to come and hold office here on behalf of the crown, on behalf of the British crown. So it was all men. Then there was fear, obviously, that these are men, they will soon have babies. And the babies will claim the citizenship of Britain via a policy we call jus sanguinis. Sanguine is a Latin word for blood. It is the system that is used in most parts of Europe, in most parts of the world, actually, which is used to recognize citizenship for people. So when they say jus sanguinis, sanguine being a Latin word for blood, it means the right of blood, meaning if any of your parents belongs to that country, then you are also a citizen of that country. It is as against jus soli, the right of soil, whereby you become a citizen of the country in which you were born. I know that many South Africans, even prominent South Africans, they wrongly believe that is the system that is in operation in South Africa. No, it's not. You don't get citizenship simply because you were born here. It doesn't work that way. Because our system is jus sanguinis, which obviously we inherited from the British because they were our colonial masters. So they were scared that via jus sanguinis, a black child will appear in Britain, you know.
And say that I am British because my father is British.
Yes, of course.
Well, so we have people that really believe that. I mean, there's been a, I'm sure you might have heard about it, there's been an interesting interview that happened on SABC some time back as questions were being asked about the independence of Zimbabwe. And one of the speakers there was talking about how great Zimbabwe is and so forth. And the anchor asked the question, well, if Zimbabwe is so great, why aren't you going back to go and support the economy there? And he argued that he's here because, one, he has been called to come to South Africa, but also his children are South African because they are born to South African mothers. So you're saying to me that is not the case?
No. If they are born to a South African mother, as I said, in jus sanguinis,
yes,
it says if one of your parents, just one.
Oh, one.
It doesn't matter where you are born.
Yes.
It doesn't matter.
Yes.
You could have been born in China, and it doesn't matter in which period. You could have been born 50 years ago. Probably.
Yes.
And then if you can arrive here and prove that one of the parents who gave birth to you is a South African, then you become a South African,
right,
automatically.
Okay.
That's why children of people who were born in exile became South African because we are using jus sanguinis. Now, those who confuse it with jus soli is about children who are born of two foreign parents, but are born on this soil.
Ah.
Yes. Are they citizens? Many people believe yes. I've seen people marching to Home Affairs coming to demand that these children are born here. If you don't give them certificates, they become stateless because they were born here in South Africa. Do you know how many South Africans are in China now?
But they're not suddenly Chinese, right?
Yes. Do you think they are going to be suddenly Chinese because they were born there? It doesn't work like that. So in fact, jus sanguinis is used in the whole of Europe, except in Luxembourg. It's used in the whole of Asia, except in Pakistan. Here on the African continent, funny, all these countries are using jus sanguinis, the right of blood, except Lesotho, Tanzania, Chad, and I think Cape Verde. I know there are only four. All the other countries are using jus sanguinis, the right of the soil. But when it comes to South Africa, for some funny reason, they believe the right of blood, the right of blood, not of soil.
Mm.
They believe we must use the issue of the right of the soil, that this child was actually born here. Now, I suspect the reason that it is so is because the Americans, being descendant of the British, I'm sure you are aware it is,
yes,
Britain,
yep,
which went to colonize America,
yep,
they were using juice Yeah, they were using juice sanguinis, the right of blood, because they took it from Britain. But somewhere around 1886, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere around there, they induced the 14th Amendment to their constitution to include juice solely. And they had a good reason as Americans. Americans took people from the African continent and made them slaves in America.
Yes.
Yes. Most of the black Americans who are there, yes, who are now called African Americans, they went there as slaves.
Sure.
When slavery was abolished, they could no longer say go back home. They couldn't bring them back to Africa. So they had a problem. And so they induced the 14th Amendment to the American Constitution and included juice solely, the right of soil, so that those who are born there then can become Americans. So right, they are using the two systems.
So that protocol, that way of determining citizenship, whether it's due sanguine or it's due what? What's the soil?
Solely for soil.
Had been a bit of an issue for us here in South Africa, because we hadn't really streamlined these issues because of certain historical reasons. And we have now come to a place where the policy in South Africa is what? Due sanguine.
Yes, it's due sanguine, the policy. Our Citizenship Act has always been like that.
Okay.
But we just worried that the manner in which our due sanguinis copied the Citizenship Act that was passed in 1949, which specifically was to protect Britain from a black invasion, if I put so,
yes,
black or colored,
yes,
invasion.
Yes.
Yeah, there's no way we can pass such an act. So that act, if you read it, it never talks about mother. It says father.
Yes, yes.
I'm sure you are aware, because the people who were sent here were men.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
So whoever drafted the bill in 1995, just remove the word parent and put the word...
remove the word parent. Father and
yeah,
replace it with parent, yeah.
Parent, because he thought then it would be neutral, it would be better in terms of our gender equality in South Africa. Because if you say father, South Africans won't agree.
Mm.
But if you say parent, they'll think it's good. But when you read the whole act, it still have the things like, to get citizenship, you have got to be a person of a sound mind. What do you read into that?
Yeah.
What do you mean by a sound mind?
Yes.
Obviously, it was a British act to say any black who comes here, we can declare them of an unsound mind and refuse them entry. And that 49 Act made it very clear that children born of South African mothers, but of British fathers who came into the colonies, will remain citizens of the colonies. There's no way they will claim British citizenship despite due sanguinis.
Mm.
So we need to change that and get an act which is suitable for our time and for our democracy.
That, as far as Citizenship Act is concerned. Talk to me very quickly,
yes,
about the other two acts, the Refugees Act and the Immigration Act.
Let's look at the Refugee Act.
Yeah.
When the Refugee Act was passed in 1998, there were winds of change on the African continent. I'm sure you remember,
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
Winds of change with Mandela here at the helm. There were a lot of changes on the continent. Countries that used to be ruled by dictators suddenly became democracies. Countries that never had an election, never had periodic election, as espoused by Article 21 of the Universal Human Rights, you know, of the United Nations. Article 21 about periodic elections, free and fair elections. Many countries were not having that. They started only now, you know. So those which used to be ruled by people who came into power via coups, they were suddenly not recognized. So everything was looking fine. It is the time at which our Refugee Act was enacted, which means it was not considering serious hardships which we are now experiencing. And so quite a number of things are actually a mistake there. That has cost lots of thugs to come and run into South Africa whenever they've got problems,
yep,
or created problems in their country.
Yep.
Here, you remember people like Rodov and Kreger, you know? Yes. Who actually confronting homeless to go back home. And if we had to face him in an open court, they were going to show our act and say, but your act allow him to be here. You know, people like Fulgence Kayishema.
Yeah.
The Rwandan genocidia, who killed 2,000 women and children during the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, and rushed here to South Africa to become a refugee, you know.
Mm.
And the most recent one you'll remember, Aubrey, is the Afghans.
Yeah.
Who tried to enter the country via Beijing. Yeah, you remember that was
the 22 tourists, yeah.
Yes, they said they are tourists in other countries like Zimbabwe.
Yes.
But when they came here, they said they are refugees,
yeah.
You know. And remember, they won in court, if you remember.
Yes.
The reason that they didn't come is their lawyer said they were too scared that everybody in South Africa was angry. Of course, we had to get angry because I wanted people to know what's happening. But why we lost is because of Section 2. Of the Refugee Act enacted in 1998.
What does that section say?
Well, look, firstly, remember refugees and asylum seekers are controlled by international conventions. The United Nations Convention of 1951, the United Nations Protocol of 1967, the Organization of African Unity, Convention of 1969. All of them, they guide. Now, in order, once a country accede to those conventions, they must now domesticate them in a form of a South African law. So the domestication of some of the things on the convention were done in the Refugee Act of 1998. Now, here is the problem. That convention has got 46 rather,
yeah.
Articles.
Yeah.
It has got 46 articles. Article 33 talks about non-refoulement. Non-refoulement is a French word meaning non-refoulee. Refoulement is refoulee,
yes,
in French. But we are English speaking, yeah. Not French speaking. So we just said refoulement. It says you cannot refoul a person, meaning take them back to a country where they ran away from. If there's clear evidence that once they arrive there, they'll be caught, persecuted, or even executed. That is subsection 1 of Article 33. But now even United Nations knew that there will be thugs and trotties and rascals like Rodov and Kreger. So they gave a leeway by adding a sub-Article 2 under Article 33. That says under certain conditions, you can refoul, you can send that person back, you can reject them, you know, because if they are a threat to the national security of your country or to peace and order and stability,
indeed,
in your country, you can send them back regardless of the consequences.
Last week Thursday, Dr. Aaron Mudzwaledi, and I'm sure you'd be aware of this one, some chaps in Kimberley, coming from Nigeria, we are told, were arrested because they caused havoc in Kimberley.
Yes.
They were vandalizing police station, the police station and cars and so forth. In fact, they organized themselves to come and intimidate the police officers at the at that particular police station. And it wasn't the first time something like this had taken place. What does the law say about that?
I saw it and I was very angry.
You are not the only one that was angry.
I was very angry because if you read the statements, no, it was being polite, malicious damage to property and all that. I don't think other countries around the world would look at it that way. That is
if we can just be honest, these were men of military age that had organized themselves to attack a
a national key point? I mean, what do you call that in other languages? I mean, what is that thing? Isn't that some form of insurrection?
Yes, to me, it definitely is. From our side, as Home Affairs, we are going to check their status, but don't be surprised if they go to court and win. Because I was still giving you... So, when Parliament domesticated that refoulement, Article 33, unfortunately, they only domesticated sub-Article 1, which talks about non-refoulement. I listened to many people who were opposing, especially from Helen Sussman Foundation and Scala Brini, who were opposing the white paper. They were saying, "Yo, this man wants to refoul people to send them back where they're going to die and all that." No, all we wanted is when we do that law, we are going to domesticate sub-Article 2, which allows us that when somebody is a threat to our security, you've got to do something about it. You've got to, the sovereignty of our country must become supreme.
Laws. But Dr. Muntswaledi, you've just said to me that what is in the white paper is now policy. What just needs to happen is that it needs to be promulgated into a bill, and that bill needs to be signed off by the president to make it law. How is it policy? And if they go to court, they're going to win. How is that going to happen?
Because policy is not law. It's not yet an act.
Yes.
You've got to put in an act that say if you do this, this is what will happen to you. Otherwise, if it's still on the base of policy alone, you'll have a bit of problems. Policy is a foundation of what law you are going to make. Take for instance, you remember the white paper on marriage?
Yes.
Yes. Where we're saying we are going to have one omnibus marriage for all South Africans in one act and all that. Remember, after passing the white paper, we had to do a bill which we sent to Parliament, is still in front of Parliament. Now, you can't get married in terms of that policy. That policy has got proposals, but the bill is the one that is going to help you conduct marriage. You can't go to court and say, I'm married in terms of the white paper.
Minister, it sounds to me like our policies at this stage, as much as they are designed to make sure that one, the sovereignty and independence of South Africa is maintained, but also that the immigration, the citizenship, all of those issues, citizenship, immigration, legislation is such that it provides the best services for anybody who is here as a refugee or as an immigrant, that they get the best hospitality South Africa can get. But it appears that all of these laws have become impotent, because you're right, we keep losing, South Africa keeps losing these cases in the courts. What are we going to do?
Well, Aubrey, if you read the white paper, we are citing SP bibliography, 47 judgments in court to show what the judges are saying. And it is from those that we picked up the mistakes in the acts and all that. And so that's why we need to change. But we said part of the problem why we're here is because there was no overarching policy. South Africa never had an overarching policy on this issue of migration. Remember, migration is an international phenomenon. Nobody can stop it, if you understand what I mean.
Mm.
It's all over the world. But what you can do is to put very clear policies and laws. So we never had that overarching policy. We're now having it. Now, the good thing about passing a white paper, which is a policy, is that nobody can make a law that deviates from that white paper. Part of the reason why these fellows who were attacking us issuing statements is because they know that. You remember that Helen Sussman Foundation?
Yes.
Even said they are calling upon members of parliament not to pass the law, if you understand what
yes,
I mean.
Yes.
Because they know that whatever law is going to happen will be on the basis of the white paper. And remember, there's been a lot of noise that what Minister Mtswaledi is doing is on his own. We had there's no support
yes,
and all
yes,
that. He's
yes.
just doing his own thing. Now that this was adopted and passed by a cabinet, you should understand, endorsed by a cabinet and even passed it, that's what shocked them. If you read the statement from Helen Suzman Foundation, they say they are disgusted by the action of the cabinet.
Yeah.
That's what the statement is saying.
So ultimately, when can we expect this policy, this white paper, to become a law?
No. The white paper is already a policy. It's an official policy.
Sure. But
yes,
but it must first become a law before we can win cases.
Sorry?
It must become a law before we can win cases in court. Otherwise, we're doomed to failure in court.
Hush. Look, that's a deep legal field. Maybe let me leave it to lawyers. Because some of the policies we put there can work in the form of a regulation. And regulations need not really follow the same process as the law. I'm saying so because away from what me and you are discussing now, there's another recommendations, for instance, about spaza shops and about about spaza shops and about visas. You know, you remember the story on visas? We are making proposals there about certain types of visas. Some of them may not need an act of parliament, but they may just need a regulation that is gazetted. They might just need a gazetted regulation.
But you know as well as I do, Minister, that you're going to be challenged at that level. As long as something is not yet law, you will be challenged, and on the basis that it's not law, not because it's good law, bad law, but because it's not law, you will be challenged and you will lose.
As I'm saying, Aubrey, that's why I said me and you, because we are not lawyers. We may end up misleading the public who are listening now.
Yeah.
Yes, but I am saying certain things you can just do. For instance, on the issue of spaza shops, we are not looking into making a law. All we are saying is we had a workshop which consists of district mayors, metro mayors, House of Traditional Leaders, organizations of traditional leaders like Contralesa. We spent 2 days in October at the Beachwood Hotel. Because they were complaining about this issue, one of the resolutions we took was that we need to audit all the spaza shops in the country. And when you audit them, they must be registered. You understand what
yes.
I mean?
Yes.
And when you register, you must produce a document. A document either as an ID of South Africa or an asylum seeker permit or some permit that allows you to be here in South Africa. If you can't produce that, obviously we'll have to deport you. And using the present laws that have got problems, we'll still use them to deport you. And we don't need to pass any law about this issue. But we say...
Minister, I've run out of time, but this is obviously something that requires a master class. For us as South Africans to understand not only how these laws work, but what their implications are in law. Isn't there perhaps a process that we can start, perhaps endorsed by yourselves at the Department of Home Affairs, that can start that education process to say, oh, this law... Because I think what happens for most South Africans is that we see how other countries handle issues of immigration, handle issues of asylum seeking and citizenship, and we automatically assume that that is the protocol for all countries. We are learning that we have certain laws that were perhaps ill-conceived because of certain historical factors and so forth that are constantly putting this country and its people under a lot of danger. As you've already put about people such as Krejcer, isn't it time now that we as South Africans go into a process where we actually understand how these laws work so that there isn't so much tension?
Well, look, if you go deep into the white paper, we are actually outlining some of them, perhaps maybe not in the depth that you like. For instance, many of the countries, when they acceded, to the United Nations Convention of 1951, they made use of Article 42 because the United Nations became aware that out of the 46 articles, what will happen if one country is objecting to just one article and say, no, this one is impossible for a country or is undesirable or is just outright, you know, something that we cannot be able to achieve. Do they reject the whole convention because of one article? So United Nations knew that as far back as 1951, they put Article 42, which allows you to post reservations. That will say, look, I know I'm acceding to this convention, but Article this and that, no, it doesn't bind my country.
Yes.
Many of them say we regard it just as a recommendation. It's not an obligation on us. Now they posted those reservations. We were not allowed as South Africa during that period because we're under apartheid. We only got into the conventions. We only got there on the 1st of December, 1996. That's when we acceded to the convention. But unfortunately, for the same reasons me and you have just discussed, we entered that without any reservation whatsoever.
Dr. Mzolidi, I have to stop because we've run out of time.